every once in a while, offer an evening to respond to any questions you may have about the concepts of Buddhism and any questions you may have or want to share about your meditation practice. So, floor is open for questions or comments. John.
I have been having longer and longer stretches of stillness where I don't think, and I love it. I call it no think. That's kind of, so it's strange. I don't know whether that comes with time or whether other people are having that experience, but I like it. It's just still.
Yep. Congratulations. You've been practicing a long time.
What happened during that time?
Been happening for years. I mean,
what happened during that time, anyway?
stillness. No, I'm not thinking.
Nothing.
I'm seeing a color. It's a kind of like a dream I had when I was a kid.
I see.
It's interesting. Oh. I was on TV for 20 years. I always did videos, so maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe I'm a video person.
Could be. Questions, comments? Nobody? Satish.
So, how do you treat these thoughts and disturbances that come along when you're meditating? It could be pain, or it could be thoughts, could be anything. I like.
There are different levels of practice in that regard. So when the thoughts come up, I've said this before, there's a part of the brain that's already always generating some kind of story. In fact, in neuroscience, it's called the default mode network. It has to do with your self-identity and the stories that you tell yourself about life experience, good, bad, or just nonsense. So initially with practice, mindfulness of breathing, or with loving kindness practice, a different channel is tuned into. It doesn't mean that the thoughts aren't happening somewhere in your subconscious. You're just not consciously aware of it. And what you're consciously aware of kind of gets stronger, more accessible. It's called long-term potentiation. So, when you notice your mind is creating a story, you just change channels. You go back to the breath, or you go back to the loving kindness practice, multiple times. And the more you do that, the part of the brain that's associated with self-regulation is strengthened. And the part of the brain that's associated with what John is calling no think, it's basically samadhi, which is concentration or stability of attention. It's very can be very quiet. Initially you're training for that effect to interrupt, change channels, and strengthen the channel that has to do with samadhi. And with enough practice, that becomes a regular point of reference, not just when you're meditating, but also during the day, particularly on a retreat. And then another level of practice comes up. And when I say it's not like you when you leave Florida and you cross this imaginary line, you're in Georgia. And when you're driving up the highway, maybe the pavement changes, but everything else, it's just countryside. So, in the same way that we're talking about this, once you've learned how to set aside the hindrances, the storyline, so forth and so on, then you start to realize, even though thoughts are perhaps peripheral in your awareness, I often talk about it as being voices in the other room with the door closed. Know that it's there, but it's not dominant. Then the practice of Vipassana really starts to happen, which is to be clearly aware of the insubstantial and fleeting characteristics of the storyline. And so that's the more the quality of attention there is very subtle, requires a lot of stability and quietness, but then there's a realization of the fabricated nature of subjective experience, which may or may not have anything to do with the storyline. In other words, there might be an awareness of the storyline in the other room. It really is like a voice in there talking. I know that there's something going on in that part of my brain. Just not interested in it. At that point, the practice can move to the level of recognizing that everything that occurs in consciousness is fleeting and insubstantial. Fabricated. And that's what leads, you know, further into awakening. So those are two different levels of working with the narrative, the selfing story. Is that helpful?
Thank you.
John?
When you all of a sudden I became aware of breath and this no think, I'm curious to know if that is a sensing ability or having to do with quiet, like you can hear the fans in the background and you can hear yourself breathe. You know, there's stillness between breaths and there's a difference between the in-breath and the out-breath. One is longer. But what, I just never thought about it until it just happened. You know, that all of a sudden I'm hearing the breath, where before I was almost hearing nothing, you know?
Well, one of the things that can happen, John, is that there, you know, we start out, there's an awareness, this is the in-breath, this is the out-breath. But when the practice gets to a certain level of insight, the mind isn't even interested in determining whether that sensation is the in-breath or the out-breath. It's just change. It's all it is. And it's sensational in that obviously there's some conscious awareness of something, but it's less and less personalized. So that's, I think that's part of what Vipassana is about. You know, insight, Vipassana, insight meditation, is about cultivating direct subjective awareness of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, to use the classic terms. Anicca basically means the transient nature of subjective experience. It's a flow, right? It's not stationary. The mind might become organized around a particular identity or story in the same way that a cyclone becomes organized around a center. Right? It spins. Whirlpool does that, right? But it's still changing. So that's what anicca is. Anatta is, I kind of alluded to that in my conversation with John just now, that anatta is any interest in identifying what's being experienced as personal, this is me, or what's called duality, a subject-object kind of situation, that there seems to be an observer and there seems to be something which is being observed. That's the anatta realization that kind of dissolves. Apparently, there's no perceived need to individuate or create a duality in the mind of observer and that which is observed. There's just suchness, it's called. And dukkha is just clear awareness of the experience of craving and clinging. And in a more direct way, the experience of distress. There's an urgent reactivity to some degree. I mean, it tends to lessen in its potency as the process of awakening matures, but there's still this felt sense of urgency, which is craving, either for pleasantness to be experienced and be always active and always satisfying, or for pain to be avoided, never experienced, gotten rid of. And so that's the craving part and the distress part. The confusion has to do with clinging. And clinging basically is the conditioned misperception that there's an enduring autonomous self. That's the duality part, the observer and that which is observed. So that kind of insight is progressive in terms of, you know, it's like building. You're building this. You're nurturing this capacity, and it progresses toward awakening. But that progression is not steady state. It's touch and go. It's three steps forward, two steps back. And that's the experience of dukkha, is that sense of dissatisfaction and confusion. The mind creates an ideal situation, an ideal self-identity, an ideal expectation of the world. And it's ideal, it's conceptual. And then there's what really happens. And so that distinction between what the mind creates as the self and as the world, and the unreliability of believing that entirely is what dukkha is about. That's the confusion part. Is that helpful?
Yeah.
Did that spin off any questions, comments from anyone? Julian.
Hi, Peter. Hi, everyone. I have a question about... I attended a series of talks from a Tibetan monk. He visited Mexico City. And I was... he talks about the practice of something like receiving and sending... yeah, he didn't mention the Tibet word. I didn't hear it, the Tibetan word, but it's, as you say, Tonglen. Mm-hmm. And my question is, can it be similar to practicing some heart qualities? How, if you could talk more about this practice.
Sure. In the Tibetan, there's different ways to describe kindness and compassion and generative joy or empathetic joy. And the Pali term is metta for loving kindness, and karuna for compassion, and mudita for empathetic joy, being able to appreciate and enjoy the happiness of others unselfishly. And that's all brought in balance by upekkha, which is equanimity. Now, those are considered in the Pali tradition, those are considered to be the four divine abidings. And compassion and empathetic joy are subsets of loving kindness and, you know, different applications of it, if you will. And then equanimity is what brings balance to that. So the word for compassion in Tibetan is Tonglen. So it's compassion practice. They're actually what's called the Lojong training principles. And I'm actually starting to study them now because I think they'd be very useful. And basically, I think there's 59 of these study points. And at the core of it is the practice of Tonglen. And basically, what it means is, and just this is once again compassion, because we're empathetic creatures, we're social animals, we are sensitized to the behavior of others. Not just what a person says, but their body language, their tone of voice, you know, all the different kinds of circumstances that occur. So, one of the basic practices for cultivating Tonglen is concentrating the mind. And in the Pali Canon version, loving kindness is a way to concentrate the mind, but also mindfulness of breathing. So in the Lojong training, first part of the practice is to cultivate what's called relative bodhicitta. Bodhi means awakened, citta is mind. And I think in the Pali, that's equivalent to what's called upachara samadhi, which is access concentration. And what it means is the mind is relatively still and quiet. John was talking about samadhi. Well, actually, it's called shamatha, which means tranquility and as well as stability or concentration. So that's considered to be a ground. And in that practice of Tonglen, you become aware of receiving, sensing something going on around you. You know, it could be a person, could be a dog, whatever, you know, just that empathy is stirred up. But with the skillful means that come with the meditation practice, you have cultivated this relative bodhicitta, a quiet, non-reactive awareness. Then being aware of that suffering that's you're witnessing, it doesn't stick. Instead, there's an awareness this is suffering, and there's an intentional transformation of that into compassion. And the compassion might require taking action to help someone who's been injured or some other misfortune. It might also just be one of the most compassionate things I can do when I'm in a tense situation with another person is to be quiet and not get stirred up by whatever's going on for them. And then from that quiet place to be able to formulate, fabricate a socially beneficial response, which is compassion. It might mean just being quiet. You know, there are any number of things it could mean. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're supposed to fix it for that other person. You may not have the resources, or they may not be open to it. But your response is more kind to the whole situation for yourself and the other person. And that's a manifestation of compassion. Does that help, Julian?
Yeah, particularly also what you highlight or stress that for that to be effective, one should. There should be this calm abiding, there should be this loving kindness So like starting from the ground level will be like equanimous mind.
Right. Equanimous mind, that's the relative bodhicitta in that Tibetan tradition.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions, comments? Yes, sir. Satish.
So earlier you mentioned that we are in an illusion of being a separate.
That's person. Yeah, and actually that's one of the first training steps in the Lojong training
yeah.
is to regard your immediate subjective experience as an illusion.
Yes. And so if that's an illusion, aren't all these practicing practices strengthening the illusion?
No, they're seeing the illusion as an illusion, but fabricating a different response to it.
Who is doing that?
That's the question, isn't it? Who is this? What is this? That was actually what the topic of Leslie's talk last week. What is this?
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so there's this delusional aspect. Life is a fabrication. It's fantastic. It's illusory. All right. So is your illusory response either going to be beneficial or hurtful to you or someone else or the world? And so there's a different way the fabrication of a self is approached initially. But ultimately, what really completely empowers that is a direct realization of the unconditioned, which would be nirvana or the Tao or whatever.
I have a sharing.
Amar.
Yeah. Hi, Peter. Hi, Sangha. I'm happy to be here. I feel like the word shamatha, Peter, you mentioned the definition and it aligns with what I know about it from Thich Nhat Hanh. That it means stop, like, and it's helped me. It comes up spontaneously when, for me in my being or my mind, when I am, my thoughts start to go downwards in a spiral. But right at the beginning or close to the beginning, maybe they go down a couple of steps and then the word comes up in my mind and I stop and sometimes I just stop my body if I'm walking, or I take one deep breath or a couple of breaths, maybe three, and then that helps me. I would like you to talk about that and follow up that the near enemy and the far enemy, that's I struggle with. I mean, I do good things in that situation, like you said, where you are present and you don't react and you try to respond however it is. It may be just being quiet. But some of it seeps in to my being, to, and it may not come. I take it, absorb it, kind of the energy or the negativity. And it might not come out then, but I feel like it inevitably comes out later on.
When you say absorb it, does that mean just be presently aware of it? Or does that mean identify with it as this is who I am?
Eventually, yeah, it unconsciously that this is, I am this as well, that the negativity, and it could be ancestral, it could be from parents. For example, if my mom is having a frustrating time or suffering, you know, dukkha, then she reacts in a way, then I kind of maybe the near enemy is guarded against by being present, but I feel like inevitably a couple of days later, a week later, the far enemy shows up, and
The what shows up?
the far
Far
enemy.
enemy. Okay, right.
Far enemy.
Yeah, that's what I just want you to talk about that,
Sure.
those things.
So you mentioned stop. I would say another term to use could be open. Stop might mean stop clinging. Being open, obviously, is a an antithesis of clinging. When you were talking, I was thinking of a quote from Analio, who I really respect as a scholar and a teacher, said that the essence of concentrating the mind is come occurs through letting go. When we're talking about concentrating the mind, he's not talking about, sharply focused. What he's talking about is a quiet mind, a stable mind. Okay, so put that in the context of relative bodhicitta or compassion, karuna, or metta, loving kindness. Now, near enemy and the far enemy. all of those things, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, all of them, a system has been developed over the centuries that describes the near enemy and the far enemy. That represents a kind of polarity, a conceptual polarity. So you get it, can make a distinction, right? So loving kindness is unselfish and kind and not greedy. And the far enemy of loving kindness is aversion and ill will. So inside, the mind gets hooked into avoidance of perhaps aggression about the a situation that would otherwise be, you would bring loving kindness to. So that's the far enemy of loving kindness is aversion and ill will. The near enemy is idealized, romantic attachment. And when I say romantic, I'm not talking about a Victorian novel necessarily. I'm talking about an idealized version. I'm going to love you the way I think you should be loved. That's the near enemy. What happens if you don't respond in the way I expect? Well, then I become angry and resentful. That's the far enemy. So that describes a certain kind of polarity regarding loving kindness. Now, with compassion, the far enemy of compassion is harshness and cruelty. And harshness can be just simply environmental. Someone is their home is destroyed by a tornado, or they become seriously ill. Cruelty is imposed. Someone actively injures you. That's cruelty. So that's the far enemy of compassion. The near enemy of compassion is pity. And that's a tricky one to try to parse that out. One of the aspirations of the practice of the path is to dissolve the sense of separation, the distinction between self and other dissolves. I talked about this earlier. And so when a person is conditioned by pity, there's a sense of separation. You poor thing. You're less than. With compassion that's not afflicted by the near enemy, the act of compassion is a sense of empathic attunement, kind of empathize with the feeling that another of what another person's going through. And that's one thing that's really interesting in terms of humanity is that infants, when infants are studied in a social setting, in other words, a bunch of little kids, crawlers, interacting with one another. They're quite young. They're not walking yet. Probably less than a year or maybe less than 18 months old. When one of them is emotionally affected, they start to cry, it gets a response from the other ones. So that empathy is hardwired into humanity. I mean, it's hardwired into all kinds of pack animals. My dog is very empathic. She vibes off of what's going on in the room. And so that experience of empathetic attunement is a core part of compassion and sympathetic joy for that matter. But in terms of the near enemy and far enemy, the ability to empathize with another being's pain or loss or whatever, their distress and confusion, and respond in ways that are beneficial, like I said, with the loving kindness. The kindest thing I might do in a situation, the most compassionate thing, might be to be silent rather than throwing my opinion in. Might be the kindest for myself, might be the kindest for that other person. Same thing is true with compassion. So the act of compassion might involve doing something extraordinary. It might not, but there's a quality of wisdom that's brought to that decision-making process. That's what we're trying to do is so that the polarity of the far enemy and the near enemy is not there. It's more in the zone, so to speak, of compassion. Sympathetic joy is empathy, but it's the ability to empathize with someone else's success and happiness. The far enemy of that is jealousy and envy, right? The near enemy is what I call the fanboy phenomena. Now, that's not a classical Buddhist analysis. That's my understanding of it. You can be incredibly joyful when your team wins, if your team wins, right? Whatever the sport is. That's the near enemy of sympathetic joy. So there's this, once again, that kind of idealizing of the situation in terms of what you bring to the encounter about your own generosity, your own open-heartedness in a situation. And generosity is very closely associated with sympathetic joy. I think so is gratitude. I gave a Dharma talk about this within the last year. I think it was go to Thanksgiving Eve of 2025 in the archives and look it up. I talked about that distinction. And so the ability to empathize with someone else's happiness when it's unselfish is buoyant, it's uplifting, it's joyful. And it doesn't require, I mean, it doesn't involve jealousy or envy, which create a sense of separation. Just like pity creates a sense of separation with compassion, jealousy and envy creates a sense of separation in terms of I can't be happy because you have what I want. The status, the information, the resources, whatever, right? So that's the near and far enemy of sympathetic joy, mudita. And the last one is upekkha, which is equanimity. And the far enemy of equanimity is attachment. It means, stuck in some kind of empathetic situation. Because once again, all four of these are organized around empathy. We are hardwired social animals for empathy. And so that quality of attachment is the far enemy. And you can see how that would be associated with jealousy and envy, and how it would be associated with pity. And so the near enemy of equanimity is numbness, shutting down inside. So, being kind to someone, if you're faking it, so to speak, it won't be heartfelt. You'll be doing it because you're supposed to do it. There's not really that sense of joyful engagement. And the same thing is true with compassion and sympathetic joy. So equanimity brings balance to that. The far enemy is attachment, the near enemy is shutting down emotionally, not allowing oneself to be aware of the empathetic vibe in the situation. When I say not allowing oneself, it's not like there's a conscious decision. Sometimes I think people do decide, I'm not going to let myself feel this, but it's more of a an unconscious resistance that occurs. So, is that helpful, Amar? You're still muted.
Yeah, sorry about that. That's very, very helpful. Seeing them as the near enemy and the far enemy as polarities, and the middle ground between the two polarities is where the equanimity lies, or the compassion lies, or the empathy lies,
Well, the
is
equanimity is the balance point for loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy.
okay.
That's how that operates.
Yeah. And I was thinking before that the far enemy is near and far. I was understanding those terms as in time and space. Like yes, you're kind right now, but if you're not truly in equanimity right now in that situation, the far enemy will show up in 2 weeks.
Or
That's
2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Like I said,
Yeah.
I'm going to give you the perfect gift, Amar, and by golly, you better appreciate it. So my generosity is spoiled for me, because I had this a notion of what your behavioral response should be, right? And that's delusional.
Yeah. And so to really be in equanimity, if you're on the breath, when you're responding to the situation, even quiet, being quiet is a response, like you said. If you're really in the present moment when the situation is happening, then you will not ex experience the polarity, is what I'm understanding.
The polarity will be lessened. That's
Lesson.
what I was starting at first. When I was first talking, I was saying there's different stages. Becoming genuinely generous is an important developmental step. And when I say generous, I mean in a situation. It might be that tomorrow, the situation, I'm not generous. But today, the conditions of the self and the world promote generosity. Now, the training, the discipline of meditation practice helps us to use those capabilities more skillfully, more they're more accessible and more effective, right? And so that's where the mindfulness of breathing plays in. It gives you a stable point of reference and cultivates. The two words that are practically synonymous, samadhi and shamatha. My understanding of shamatha basically means that the mind is still and the emotions are tranquil, right? And so that's relative bodhicitta in terms of practice of Tonglen. But it applies to all to loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. But the part that works with equanimity is to be mindful, right? That's how you find that sweet spot, loving kindness and sympathetic joy and compassion. But it's not like it's a steady state. We move from one circumstance to another, and our internal response set changes, right? It's never going to be the same. So sometimes you're more awarely, actively, genuinely generous, and every time you're faking it. But it's important to be able to be aware of that and make the distinction to recognize, okay, I was trying to be generous here, but I'm still a little bit off balance, right? Maybe I'm a little bit resentful that the person didn't say thank you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, it does make sense for me. Thank you, Peter. Yeah.
Love these questions. More questions?
I have a comment.
All right,
Comment.
Satish.
So, I don't know all this technology you mentioned, all these different terms and stuff. What I try to do, and I say I with hesitation, is whatever is happening. I'm not doing it, and the other person is not doing it. It's just happening. So that brings oneness automatically. If they're doing something bad, it's just happening. It's not that they're doing it. So likewise, myself, the compassion comes in that way. Of course, I'm not perfect by any means, but that's what I try to do. That's what my practice is. I try to be aware that whatever is happening, it happens. Me or in the universe, and you mentioned earlier, whatever is happening is transient. So I take that into account. So that's where I come from. Do you have any comments?
Well, yeah, you're describing the experience. I mean, I can certainly relate to what you're saying, Yeah, it makes sense. That could leave the door open to some sense of nihilism, of what's the point? Everything is just what it is. And so there's a letting go of agency. I'm not saying that's what you're saying, but that's a potential that a person just goes limp.
Yeah, if that happens, that's what's happening. The
Right.
person goes
But
limp.
is that wholesome? Right. And that's the question. Is that wholesome? And what wholesome in terms of what conditions? Right. When I'm saying this, I'm remembering somebody sitting in this room years ago. You might even have been in the room too, John. The fellow was sitting over there. He was, I think, from Central America originally. And I was talking about compassion and equanimity and so forth. And he said in a kind of angry tone of voice, well, what if somebody, broke into your house and grabbed one of your relatives and took them away and you never saw them again? And this is the time of civil war in Central America, right? Or at least it was. I think he was referring to that. He's here and he's an adult. My response was, I might have an ideal version of what I would do, right? Depending on the factors. Does that person have a gun? Do I have any kind of power in the situation? All that kind of stuff. But whatever it is, it's all happening really fast. And there's a lot of energy in the situation, a lot of adrenaline. Okay. So I cannot predict what I would do. I might be able to come up with an ideal outcome, but it's still just imagined, right? This training, this mindfulness practice, helps me to learn how to be more aware sooner and be able to respond with more appropriate agility. That's what it does. That's the practice.
It puts space between your thoughts and your response.
Right. And Shiloh Catherine has a really good book out. I can't remember the title of it right now, but it, the phrase is to create a potent pause and before responding to a situation. Other questions?
Really? I just think what you said about someone breaks in your house and people, well, anything can happen, and you have to kind of accept it when it happens. And,
Well,
you might have.
you accept the environmental circumstances. You don't shut down, you don't blank out, you're really aware of what's going on externally and internally, right?
Yeah, no, what I meant was someone bringing up that situation is pointless because anything can happen at any time. I mean, I
Right.
presume he was saying it so that, oh, you're saying this, but what if you experience
Exactly,
this? But,
yeah.
it's that's we could all do that, really, I
Yeah,
think.
I mean, I could have said, well, here's what I would do. And, I'm not even going to think about what I'm going to do because I have no idea what the situation might be. But it gives an example of how to respond effectively to a strong stimulus, whether it's desirable or undesirable. And that there's something that came to mind when I was talking with Amar about how to deal with this potent pause, basically. It's like if you have a snowball and a steep or a slope, right? And you want to make a snowman, you start the snowball rolling at the top of the hill. And if the snow conditions are right, it starts to roll faster and gets more mass. So it has more momentum. So if you really are trying to guide where this snowball goes, you got to stay in touch with it, right? And maybe you want to steer it more to the right or more to the left. Maybe you want to slow it down. Maybe you want to speed it up, whatever, right? Maybe you don't want to trip over it. But all these different circumstances are to be dealt with. The sooner you contact the snowball and the more persistent you are in paying attention to your contact with the snowball, the more you have a chance to deal with its growth and its momentum, right? That's very similar to what goes on in our thought processes, except it happens multiple times a second. Arises and falls apart, and arises and falls apart. This is standard Buddhist doctrine, but there's contemporary neuroscientific research that supports that moment by moment arising and passing away of subjective awareness. So it that's a valid understanding of how consciousness works. And another way to understand that is when I was young, we had 8 millimeter film projectors, and we would watch these documentaries in school, right? But the projectors were not very high quality, and the film had probably been played way too many times over the years, and it would start to default. It's supposed to flow through past the lens and the light at a certain speed, but it would get stuck. Sometimes it would stop and and the it would burn, right? Some of you younger folks had no experience of this, but I remember it from my youth. But one of the things that happens is it starts to flicker. You know, when the film is not running at the right speed, it starts to flicker. Well, I can tell you from my own subjective experience on a retreat one time, I had that experience. Subjectively, there was a, you know, multiple times a second, this flickering of, like being in a room with a strobe light, except it was my mind, right? So I have direct experience of that, that fluttering effect in the mind. It shocked me. My mind recoiled from it. But that's in the Buddhist literature. It's called arising and passing away. It's one of the, what are called the progressions of insight in the Theravadan tradition. So any questions, comments? John?
It seemed as though this, we've all been given this tool of awareness and how well we tune in to it, because it's always present if you're alive, and that it's what life is, you know?
Right, that tuning in is mindfulness. You know, one of the three characteristics of dukkha is ignorance, greed, hatred, and ignorance. And ignorance is when you're not tuned in. In fact, in modern psychology is a term called metacognition, which is basically the ability to accurately perceive what's going on in the mind as it's happening. Yeah, we have to be aware. In fact, for those of you who come into this room, right above the door into this meditation room, there's a sign that I made years ago. I was inspired by Jack Kornfield. When he was a monk, for some reason he was back in the States, and he went to Las Vegas and went to a casino. And there's a sign over the door, the entrance of it, says, "You must be present to win." And I assume that that has to do with the lottery or something like that. This is back in the 60s, I guess. But he picked up on that. I read it in one of his books, and I was charmed by it. So I painted a sign that says, "You must be present to win," above the door into this room. Because that's what the issue that John brought up is. Got to be paying attention. Come on, folks, help me out. I love these chats. And ask away. John?
I think the brain, you have to be aware that you don't get taken over by your own story or a story that's dominating whatever is happening. Now, like at a stop sign, you have to stop or you're liable to get killed. I mean, there are certain, and it's like you're actually describing a dogfight of what you are aware of that you can prevent. And it's interesting to know the power of awareness for someone to see this 2,500 years ago is amazing to me, that a person can see a dynamic that's been, I don't know, I guess you have to call it timeless almost.
Absolutely timeless, you betcha. And, you know, the dog fights inside us. There are two dogs inside of us, and that's what the fight is. We have to learn how to get those dogs to cooperate. The energy is the energy. It's not inherently bad. It's just a question of how the mind makes itself out of it and acts on that.
Balance, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just want to comment about...
Yeah?
Oh,
go ahead, Sharon.
I don't know. I just wanted to comment about a visual that I was trying to get when the Fish Lake people were... divesting themselves of material things. It was a clock face. So there, it's actually wall clock.
The Fish Lake people was a sangha that was organized around the teaching of Thich Nhat Hanh. I didn't want you to think that Sharon believed that she somehow or other was hanging out with a strange tribe at Fish Lake.
No, oh yeah, for those of you that don't know that, but I wanted to bring it, claim it and bring it to your meditation hall, but I can still see it. It was a large clock that hung on the wall, and every, you know how you look at a regular dial of a clock, every 5 minutes, you know, from 12 to up to 12 all the way around, the time was now. Instead of a number, it said now. And that's sort of a symbolic image for me when I want to bring myself into the present, is to imagine that, and just that visual brings me back to the now.
Yep, that's a good one. So, Satish?
My question was related to that just now. You know,
that's right.
So can you comment on that?
Well, there's only now, but the sequences of now is so rapid that they blend together and create the illusion that there's an enduring self. So the issue of now is conceptual. What you described, and it's an accurate, useful concept, the now, but life, you can't just say it just now and leave it at that. We still have to act. I mean, that's where we're born into a body that acts, right? So being aware of the now conceptually is helpful, but what really makes this work is the ability to directly notice how the now occurs and not make it personal. The moment of arising and passing away, and not, you know, let go of craving and clinging so it becomes impersonal.
The way I don't quite understand it, but the way I read about it is now is the only, now there's nothing else but now.
Right, absolutely.
No history or anything.
You might find it interesting to read a book called Stepping Out of Self-Deception.
Yeah.
It's a really good book. Our study group, we've reviewed it several times now. By Rodney Smith. It's a really good book, Stepping Out of Self-Deception.
So you're saying there's no enduring self.
Right.
And then a little while back, Sajis was saying there was a sort of suggestion of nihilism, that you decide you're not going to act and do anything. But so obviously there's no enduring.
And deciding not to act is acting.
Yeah, but if there's no enduring self, there's presumably an illusory self that's having
right.
to act and do things.
Right.
So does that have a some kind of, what's driving that, the illusory self to do that?
What is that?
What?
That's that question again. What is that?
What is that?
Were you here last Wednesday night? Were you here last Wednesday night when Leslie gave her Dharma talk? What is this?
Possibly. What? When was this? I wasn't here last week.
Yeah. So you go to the website and tune into it.
Yeah.
It's a really good talk. What is this? It comes out of Korean Zen. Stephen Batchelor, who is an author I really admire, and so does Leslie, for that matter. He was a Korean Zen monk for years. And one of their main practice strategies was, what is this? What is this? And my version of it is, what's happening? What's happening? I mean, it's kind of a mystery. What's happening? But it's very interesting. I take literally enjoy being on retreat. I really enjoy being curious about what in the world is going on here. You know, and not in just a kind of open-minded curiosity about what's going on here, what's happening, this self.
That must be an illusory self asking that, if there's a hearing self.
Yes, that it's true. It's absolutely right. There's an illusory self that's observing the illusory self.
I just wonder if there's a percentage that's actually not enduring.
Percentage?
There's a smaller percentage that is, that continues. You know, we're sort of throwing the baby out with the bathwater and sort of saying there's no enduring self, but there's a component of whatever is there that it will pass away and change, but there's a component that is central to it that will keep going.
You're assuming that component is enduring and autonomous. It's not. I mean, that's part of the great mystery. I talked about the progression earlier at the beginning of the meeting about we move through different levels of insight awareness. And one of them is the ability to dissolve even what you just described. That seems like there must be something going on there, because it seems like there's a beginning and an ending. And what Buddhism dives into is, no, there's something that goes on in the brain. It's called a binding moment of consciousness, and it involves interactions among various neural circuits that out of which emerges a subjectivity, a moment of self-awareness. And then that passes away, but that loop still has a kind of enduring quality. You've been in a room with a bright light and then closed your eyes and you see the after image, right? Mm-hmm. That's called an eidetic image. What it means is that in the back of the brain where visual processing originates, those neurons that were fired up when stimulated by the intense light source are still activated for several seconds afterwards, right? That's the eidetic effect. Well, that's going on in every moment of subjectivity, kind of brief afterburn. But the longer the afterburn is nurtured, the more vivid the image gets to be. Is that, you following me on that?
Yeah.
So that image is what we call the binding moment of consciousness. And everything I've described here happens very, very rapidly in a fraction of a second. But within a second, there are 300 of those, according to neuroscientific research. 300 of those moments of selfing, they're all bound together because of that eidetic effect. But it's not about visual stimulus, it's about cognitive process, thinking. Even when John says he goes to no think, it doesn't mean that his brain stopped operating. It just means that the part of the brain that's concocting the story is kind of in the other room with the door closed. And it's
kind
quiet.
Of like awareness when you're hunting, you know what I mean? You're waiting for this critter, animal, whatever, to come across, and everything's quiet. And your brain is eat up, but it's quiet, but it's clear. And it's loaded. I mean, I don't know what the heck to say. Hey, except that
you may know where I'm going on this, John, and then we have to stop because we're at the end of the evening. There's a really great teaching story. In fact, a book that has this title, Still Forest Pool.
Yeah.
Ajahn Chah. One of the things that he is written in the book that he had said was, when you practice samadhi, shamatha, the mind is very stable and very still. It's like sitting beside a still forest pool. If you're there long enough and you're quiet enough, all kinds of strange and wonderful animals will come there to drink. Those strange and wonderful animals are what the mind concocts. They're random thoughts or sensory impressions. But there's just, you just notice them, but there's no attachment to them. There's no friction. There's no pull. There's just flow. Like you were saying, you know, it's just what is right now, the totality of suchness. Okay, that's the final comment for tonight. I'm not sure I remember who's giving the Dharma talk next week. Do you know, Leslie?
It's Susan Baxter is going to introduce us to the hindrances.
Oh, that's right. The beginning of the fourth foundation of mindfulness. Yes. Great. All right. So it's our custom at the end of our meetings to sit together in silence briefly. So let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well, and I hope we're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.